This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. A few dozen friends of mine gave me a wonderful Christmas present. They each recorded some Christmas stories for me to broadcast. These run the gamut from spiritual to funny, from touching to shocking to scary. We got some sci-fi, we've got some poetry, there are some songs and some jokes. Robin Bullock supplied the instrumental music. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience.
The Star by Arthur C. Clarke, read by Katie Anderson. It is 3,000 light years to the Vatican. Once I believed that space could have no power over faith, just as I believed that the heavens declared the glory of God's handiwork. Now I have seen that handiwork, and my faith is sorely troubled. I stare at the crucifix that hangs on the cabin wall above the Mark VI computer, and for the first time in my life, I wonder if it is no more than an empty symbol. I have told no one yet, but the truth cannot be concealed. The facts are there for all to read, recorded on the countless miles of magnetic tape and the thousands of photographs we are carrying back to Earth. Other scientists can interpret them as easily as I can, and I am not one who would condone that tampering with the truth which often gave my order a bad name in the olden days. The crew are already sufficiently depressed. I wonder how they will take this ultimate irony. Few of them have any religious faith, yet they will not relish using this final weapon in their campaign against me, that private, good-natured, but fundamentally serious war which lasted all the way from Earth. It amused them to have a Jesuit as chief astrophysicist. Dr. Chandler, for instance, could never get over it. Why are medical men such notorious atheists? Sometimes he would meet me on the observation deck, where the lights are always low so that the stars shine with undiminished glory. He would come up to me in the gloom and stand staring out of the great oval port while the heavens crawled slowly around the ship as it turned end over end with the residual spin we had never bothered to correct. "Well, Father," he would say at last, "it goes on forever and ever, and perhaps something made it. But how you can believe that something has a special interest in us and our miserable little world, that just beats me." Then the argument would start, while the stars and nebulae would swing around us in silent, endless arcs beyond the flawlessly clear plastic of the observation port. It was, I think, the apparent incongruity of my position that caused most amusement to the crew. In vain, I would point to my 3 papers in the Astrophysical Journal, my 5 in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. I would remind them that my order has long been famous for its scientific works. We may be few now, but ever since the 18th century we have made contributions to astronomy and geophysics out of all proportion to our numbers. Will my report on the Phoenix Nebula end our 1,000 years of history? It will end, I fear, much more than that. I do not know who gave the nebula its name, which seems to me a very bad one. If it contains a prophecy, it is one that cannot be verified for several billion years. Even the word nebula is misleading. This is a far smaller object than those stupendous clouds of mist, the stuff of unborn stars that are scattered throughout the length of the Milky Way. On the cosmic scale, indeed, Phoenix Nebula is a tiny thing, a tenuous shell of gas surrounding a single star. Or what is left of a star. The Rubens engraving of Loyola seems to mock me as it hangs there above the spectrophotometer tracings. What would you, Father, have made of this knowledge that has come into my keeping, so far from the little world that was all the universe you knew? Would your faith have risen to the challenge, as mine has failed to do? You gaze into the distance, Father, but I have traveled a distance beyond any that you could have imagined when you founded our order 1,000 years ago. No other survey ship has been so far from Earth. We are at the very frontiers of the explored universe. We set out to reach the Phoenix Nebula. We succeeded. And we are homeward bound with our burden of knowledge. I wish I could lift that burden from my shoulders, but I call to you in vain across the centuries and the light years that lie between us. On the book you are holding, the words are plain to read. Ad majorem Dei Gloriam, the message runs. But it is a message I can no longer believe. Would you still believe it, if you could see what we have found? We knew, of course, what the Phoenix Nebula was. Every year in our galaxy alone, more than 100 stars explode, blazing for a few hours or days with thousands of times their normal brilliance before they sink back into death and obscurity. Such are the ordinary nova, the commonplace disasters of the universe. I have recorded the spectrograms and light curves of dozens since I started working at the Lunar Observatory. But three or four times in every 1,000 years occurs something beside which even a nova pales into total insignificance. When a star becomes a supernova, it may for a little while outshine all the massed suns of the galaxy. The Chinese astronomers watched this happen in AD 1054, not knowing what it was they saw. 5 centuries later, in 1572, a supernova blazed in Cassiopeia so brilliantly that it was visible in the daylight sky. There have been 3 more in the 1,000 years that have passed since then. Our mission was to visit the remnants of such a catastrophe, to reconstruct the events that led up to it, and, if possible, to learn its cause. We came slowly in through the concentric shells of gas that had been blasted out 6,000 years before, yet were expanding still. They were immensely hot, radiating even now with a fierce violet light, but were far too tenuous to do us any damage. When the star had exploded, its outer layers had been driven upward with such speed that they had escaped completely from its gravitational field. Now they formed a hollow shell large enough to engulf 1,000 solar systems, and at its center burned the tiny, fantastic object which the star had now become, a white dwarf smaller than the Earth, yet weighing 1,000,000 times as much. The glowing gas shells were all around us, banishing the normal light of interstellar space. We were flying into the center of a cosmic bomb that had detonated millennia ago, and whose incandescent fragments were still hurtling apart. The immense scale of the explosion, and the fact that the debris already covered a volume of space many billions of miles across, robbed the scene of any visible movement. It would take decades before the unaided eye could detect any motion in these tortured wisps and eddies of gas, yet the sense of turbulent expansion was overwhelming. We had checked our primary drive hours before, and were drifting slowly toward the fierce little star ahead. Once it had been a sun like our own, but it had squandered in a few hours the energy that should have kept it shining for 1,000,000 years. Now it was a shrunken miser, hoarding its resources as if trying to make amends for its prodigal youth. No one seriously expected to find planets. If there had been any before the explosion, they would have been boiled into puffs of vapor, and their substance lost in the greater wreckage of the star itself. But we made the automatic search, as we always do when approaching an unknown sun, and presently we found a single small world circling the star at an immense distance. It must have been the Pluto of this vanished solar system, orbiting on the frontiers of the night. Too far from the central sun ever to have known life, its remoteness had saved it from the fate of all its lost companions. The passing fires had seared its rocks and burned away the mantle of frozen gas that must have covered it in the days before the disaster. We landed, and we found the vault. Its builders had made sure that we would. The monolithic marker that stood above its entrance was now a fused stump, but even the first long-range photographs told us that here was the work of intelligence. A little while later, we detected the continent-wide pattern of radioactivity that had been buried in the rock. Even if the pylon above the vault had been destroyed, this would have remained, an immovable and all but eternal beacon calling to the stars. Our ship fell toward this gigantic bullseye like an arrow to its target. The pylon must have been 1 mile high when it was built, but now it looked like a candle that had been melted down into a puddle of wax. It took us 1 week to drill through the fused rock, since we did not have the proper tools for a task like this. We were astronomers, not archaeologists, but we could improvise. Our original purpose was forgotten. This lonely monument, reared with such labor at the greatest possible distance from the doomed sun, could only have 1 meaning. A civilization that knew it was about to die had made its last bid for immortality. It will take us generations to examine all the treasures that were placed in the vault. They had plenty of time to prepare, for their sun must have given its first warnings 1,000,000 years before the final detonation. Everything that they wished to preserve, all the fruits of their genius, they brought here to this distant world in the days before the end, hoping that some other race would find it, and that they would not be utterly forgotten. Would we have done this as well, or would we have been too lost in our own misery to give thought to a future we could never see or share? If only they'd had 1 little more time. They could travel freely enough between the planets of their own sun, but they had not yet learned to cross the interstellar gulfs, and the nearest solar system was 100 light-years away. Yet even had they possessed the secret of the transfinite drive, no more than 1,000,000 could have been saved. Perhaps it was better thus. Even if they had not been so disturbingly human as their sculpture shows, we could not have helped admiring them and grieving for their fate. They left thousands of visual records and the machines for projecting them, together with elaborate pictorial instructions from which it will not be difficult to learn their written language. We have examined many of these records and brought to life for the first time in 6,000 years the warmth and beauty of a civilization that in many ways must have been superior to our own. Perhaps they only showed us the best, and one can hardly blame them. But their words were very lovely, and their cities were built with a grace that matches anything of man's. We have watched them at work and play and listened to their musical speech sounding across the centuries. One scene is still before my eyes. A group of children on a beach of strange blue sand playing in the waves as children play on earth. Curious whip-like trees line the shore, and some very large animal is waiting in the shadows, yet attracting no attention at all. And sinking into the sea, still warm and friendly and life-giving, is the sun that will soon turn traitor and obliterate all this innocent happiness. Perhaps if we had not been so far from home and so vulnerable to loneliness, we should not have been so deeply moved. Many of us had seen the ruins of ancient civilizations on other worlds, but they had never affected us so profoundly. This tragedy was unique. It is one thing for a race to fail and die, as nations and cultures have done on Earth. But to be destroyed so completely in the full flower of its achievement, leaving no survivors? How could that be reconciled with the mercy of God? My colleagues have asked me that, and I have given what answers I can. Perhaps you could have done better, Father, but I have found nothing in the Exorcitia of Spiritualia that helps me here. They were not an evil people. I do not know what gods they worshipped, if indeed they worshipped any. But I have looked back at them across the centuries, and have watched while the loveliness they used their last strength to preserve was brought forth again into the light of their shrunken sun. They could have taught us much. Why were they destroyed? I know the answers that my colleagues will give when they get back to Earth. They will say that the universe has no purpose and no plan, that since 100 suns explode every year in our galaxy, at this very moment some race is dying in the depths of space. Whether that race has done good or evil during its lifetime will make no difference in the end. There is no divine justice, for there is no God. Yet, of course, what we have seen proves nothing of the sort. Anyone who argues thus is being swayed by emotion, not logic. God has no need to justify his actions to man. He who built the universe can destroy it when he chooses. It is arrogance, it is perilously near blasphemy for us to say what he may or may not do. This I could have accepted, hard though it is to look upon whole worlds and peoples thrown into the furnace. But there comes a point when even the deepest faith must falter. And now, as I look at the calculations lying before me, I know I have reached that point at last. We could not tell, before we reached the nebula, how long ago the explosion took place. Now, from the astronomical evidence and the record in the rocks of that one surviving planet, I have been able to date it very exactly. I know in what year the light of this colossal conflagration reached our Earth. I know how brilliantly the supernova whose corpse now dwindles behind our speeding ship once shone in terrestrial skies. I know how it must have blazed low in the east before sunrise, like a beacon in that oriental dawn. There can be no reasonable doubt. The ancient mystery is solved at last. Yet, oh God, there were so many stars you could have used. What was the need to give these people to the fire, that the symbol of their passing might shine above Bethlehem?
First, I'll begin with some poetry. The first of these is by Robert Frost, a familiar one to most of you, I'm sure, called Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near. Between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep and miles to go before I sleep. By the way, my name is Karen Rains, And the next three verses I'll be reading are original verses that I've written especially for Christmas and for the winter season. The first is entitled, The Gift. He gave us all that he could give, his word a call that we might live, his grace, his love, his ways, his law. He gave to one, he gave us all. The next is a winter poem. Its title, Snowfall. The snow lay drifted all around, in places knee-deep to the ground. The earth to muffled stillness bound, contentment cloaked in silenced sound. The next is entitled Patterns in the Snow, written as I watch the snowfall. The sun was glinting softly on drifted banks of snow that sparkled as with diamond dust, the earth and trees aglow. The snow, a velvet blanket o'er everything it touched, cloaked all in peaceful silence. The air was crisp and hushed. The bushes, heavy laden, and branches of the trees were traced with fine precision like nature's filigree. And in their midst a spider's web-like intricate design emerged among the brambles and twigs that were entwined. Within the foliage of the woods that clustered at its core, its pattern now seen clearly where none had been before. No black exhaust nor golden stream yet marred the pristine white. Surveying its beauty, I was filled with wonder and delight, and turned to see a cat who at the window stopped to share my revelry at artistry so delicate and rare. And I have a couple more pieces of poetry that are specific to Christmas. The first is a holiday tea. Come and share in Yuletide fare with holly and with berries, while chorus voices sing rejoices to the Son of Mary. We'll shed our coats and gladly toast some chestnuts in the embers, like days of old and stories told of seasons long remembered. With steaming tea, our remedy against the chill outside, we'll talk of malls and Santa Claus at joyous Christmastide. As sunbeams glance and gaily dance on velvet tufts of snow, we'll throng to see the Christmas tree bedecked with yards of bows. Then round will go the piano and form a mini choir as merrily we sing off key before a crackling fire. While shadows shift upon the drifts of snow outside the door, we'll toast our friends' goodwill to men and peace forevermore. And speaking of toasts, the next is a Christmas toast to you. May your wishes be simple, your blessings be great. May your feasting not add to your previous weight. May the new year find you and your loved ones all healthy, with happiness and with prosperity wealthy. May goodness and joy fill your holiday season, and may we remember that Christ is its reason.
The Festival by H.P. Lovecraft, read by Lauren Armitage. I was far from home, and the spell of the eastern sea was upon me. In the twilight I heard it pounding on the rocks, and I knew it lay just over the hill where the twisting willows writhed against the clearing sky and the first stars of evening. And because my fathers had called me to the old town beyond, I pushed on through the shallow, new-fallen snow along the road that soared lonely up to where Aldebaran twinkled among the trees. On toward the very ancient town I had never seen, but often dreamed of. It was the Yuletide that men call Christmas, though they know in their hearts it is older than Bethlehem and Babylon, older than Memphis and mankind. It was the Yuletide, and I had come at last to the ancient sea town where my people had dwelt and kept festival in the elder time when festival was forbidden, where also they had commanded their sons to keep festival once every century, that the memory of primal secrets might not be forgotten. Mine were an old people, and were old even when this land was settled 300 years before. And they were strange, because they had come as dark, furtive folk from opiate southern gardens of orchids, and spoke another tongue before they learnt the tongue of the blue-eyed fishers. And now they were scattered, and shared only the rituals of mysteries that none living could understand. I was the only one who came back that night to the old fishing town as legend bade, for only the poor and the lonely remember. Then, beyond the hill's crest, I saw Kingsport, outspread frostily in the gloaming. Snowy Kingsport, with its ancient vanes and steeples, ridgepoles and chimney pots, wharves and small bridges, crowned a central peak that time durst not touch. Ceaseless mazes of colonial houses, piled and scattered at all angles and levels, like a child's disordered blocks. Antiquity hovering on gray wings over winter-whitened gables and gambrel roofs. Fanlights and small-paned windows, one by one, gleaming out in the cold dusk to join Orion and the archaic stars. And against the rotting wharves, the sea pounded, the secretive, immemorial sea out of which the people had come in the elder time. Beside the road, at its crest, a still higher summit rose, bleak and windswept, and I saw that it was a burying ground, where black gravestones stuck ghoulishly through the snow, like the decayed fingernails of a gigantic corpse. The printless road was very lonely, and sometimes I thought I heard a distant, horrible creaking, as of a gibbet in the wind. They'd hanged four kinsmen of mine for witchcraft in 1692, but I did not know just where. As the road wound down the seaward slope, I listened for the merry sounds of a village at evening, but did not hear them. Then I thought of the reason, and felt that these old Puritan folk might well have Christmas customs strange to me, and full of silent hearthside prayer. So after that, I did not listen for merriment or look for wayfarers, but kept on down past the hushed lighted farmhouses and shadowy stone walls, to where the signs of ancient shops and sea taverns creaked in the salt breeze, and the grotesque knockers of pillared doorways glistened along deserted, unpaved lanes in the light of little curtained windows. I had seen maps of the town, and knew where to find the home of my people. It was told that I should be known and welcomed, for village legend lives long. So I hastened through back street to Circle Court, and across the fresh snow on the one full flagstone pavement in the town, to where Green Lane leads off behind the market house. The old maps still held good, and I had no trouble, though at Arkham they must have lied when they said the trolleys ran to this place, since I saw not a wire overhead. Snow would have hid the rails in any case. I was glad I had chosen to walk, for the white village had seemed very beautiful from the hill, and now I was eager to knock at the door of my people, the seventh house on the left, in Green Lane, with an ancient peaked roof and jutting second story, all built before 1650. There were lights inside the house when I came upon it, and I saw from the diamond window panes that it must have been kept very close to its antique state. The upper part overhung the narrow grass-grown street, and nearly met the overhanging part of the house opposite, so that I was almost in a tunnel, with a low stone doorstep wholly free of snow. There was no sidewalk, but many houses had high doors, reached by double flights of steps with iron railings. It was an odd scene, and because I was strange to New England, I had never known its like before. Though it pleased me, I would have relished it better if there had been footprints in the snow, and people in the streets, and a few windows without drawn curtains. When I sounded the archaic iron knocker, I was half afraid. Some fear had been gathering in me, perhaps because of the strangeness of my heritage, and the bleakness of the evening, and the queerness of the silence in that aged town of curious customs. And when my knock was answered, I was fully afraid, because I had not heard any footsteps before the door creaked open, But I was not afraid long, for the gowned, slippered old man in the doorway had a bland face that reassured me, and though he made signs that he was dumb, he wrote a quaint and ancient welcome with the stylus and wax tablet he carried. He beckoned me into a low, candle-lit room with massive, exposed rafters and dark, stiff, sparse furniture of the 17th century. The past was vivid there, for not an attribute was missing. There was a cavernous fireplace and a spinning wheel at which a bent old woman in loose wrapper and deep poke bonnet sat back toward me, silently spinning despite the festive season. An indefinite dampness seemed upon the place, and I marveled that no fire should be blazing. The high-backed settle faced the row of curtained windows at the left, and seemed to be occupied, though I was not sure. I did not like everything about what I saw, and felt again the fear I had had. This fear grew stronger from what it had before lessened it, for the more I looked at the old man's bland face, the more its very blandness terrified me. The eyes never moved, and the skin was too like wax. Finally, I was sure it was not a face at all, but a fiendishly cunning mask. But the flabby hands, curiously gloved, wrote genially on the tablet, and told me I must wait a while before I could be led to the place of festival. Pointing to a chair, table, and pile of books, the old man now left the room, and when I sat down to read, I saw that the books were hoary and moldy, and that they included old Morrister's wild marvels of science, the terrible Cetochismus Triumphatus of Joseph Glanville, published in 1681, the shocking Daemona Latreia of Remigius, printed in 1595 at Lyons, and, worst of all, the unmentionable Necronomicon of the mad Arab Abdul al-Hazred, in Olaus Wormius's forbidden Latin translation, a book which I had never seen, but of which I had heard monstrous things whispered. No one spoke to me, but I could hear the creaking of signs in the wind outside, and the whir of the wheel as the bonneted old woman continued her silent spinning, spinning. I thought the room and the books and the people very morbid and disquieting, but because an old tradition of my father's had summoned me to strange feastings, I resolved to expect queer things. So I tried to read, and soon became tremblingly absorbed by something I found in that accursed Necronomicon, a thought and a legend too hideous for sanity or consciousness. But I disliked it when I fancied I heard the closing of one of the windows that the settle faced, as if it had been stealthily opened. It had seemed to follow a whirring that was not the old woman's spinning wheel. This was not much, though, for the old woman was spinning very hard, and the aged clock had been striking. After that, I lost the feeling that there were persons on the settle, and was reading intently and shudderingly, when the old man came back, booted and dressed in a loose antique costume, and sat down on that very bench, so that I could not see him. It was certainly nervous waiting. The blasphemous book in my hands made it doubly so. When 11 struck, however, the old man stood up, glided to a massive carved chest in a corner, and got 2 hooded cloaks, one of which he donned, and the other of which he draped round the old woman, who was ceasing her monotonous spinning. Then they both started for the outer door, the woman lamely creeping, and the old man, after picking up the very book I had been reading, beckoning me as he drew his hood over that unmoving face, or mask. We went out into the moonless and torturous networks of that incredibly ancient town, went out as the lights in the curtained windows disappeared one by one, and the dog star leered at the throng of cowled, cloaked figures that poured silently from every doorway and formed monstrous processions up this street and that, past the creaking signs and antediluvian gables, the thatched roofs and diamond-paned windows, threading precipitous lanes where decaying houses overlapped and crumbled together, gliding across open courts and churchyards where the bobbing lanterns made eldritch drunken constellations. Amid these hushed throngs, I followed my voiceless guides, jostled by elbows that seemed preternaturally soft, and pressed by chests and stomachs that seemed abnormally pulpy, but seeing never a face and hearing never a word. Up, 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 the eerie columns slithered, and I saw that all the travelers were converging as they flowed near a sort of focus of crazy alleys at the top of a high hill in the center of the town, where perched a great white church. I had seen it from the road's crest when I looked at Kingsport in the new dusk, and it had made me shiver because Aldebaran had seemed to balance itself a moment on the ghostly spire. There was an open space around the church, partly a churchyard with spectral shafts, and partly a half-paved square, swept nearly bare of snow by the wind, and lined with unwholesomely archaic houses having peaked roofs and overhanging gables. Death fires danced over the tombs, revealing gruesome vistas, though queerly failing to cast any shadows. Past the churchyard, where there were no houses, I could see over the hill's summit and watch the glimmer of stars on the harbor, though the town was invisible in the dark. Only once in a while, a lantern bobbed horribly through serpentine alleys on its way to overtake the throng that was now slipping speechlessly into the church. I waited till the crowd had oozed into the black doorway until all the stragglers had followed. The old man was pulling at my sleeve, but I was determined to be the last. Then I finally went, the sinister man and the old spinning woman before me. Crossing the threshold into that swarming temple of unknown darkness, I turned once to look at the outside world as the churchyard phosphorescence cast a sickly glow on the hilltop pavement. And as I did so, I shuddered. For though the wind had not left much snow, a few patches did remain on the path near the door, and in that fleeting backward look it seemed to my troubled eyes that they bore no mark of passing feet, not even mine. The church was scarce lighted by all the lanterns that had entered it, for most of the throng had already vanished. They had streamed up the aisle, between the high white pews, to the trap door of the vaults which yawned loathsomely open just before the pulpit, and were now squirming noiselessly in. I followed, dumbly, down the foot-worn steps and into the dank, suffocating crypt. The tail of that sinuous line of night marchers seemed very horrible, and as I saw them wriggling into a venerable tomb, they seemed more horrible still. Then I noticed that the tomb's floor had an aperture, down which the throng was sliding, and in a moment we were all descending an ominous staircase of rough-hewn stone, a narrow spiral staircase, damp and peculiarly odorous, that wound endlessly down in the bowels of the hill, past monotonous walls of dripping stone blocks and crumbling mortar. It was a silent, shocking descent, and I observed after a horrible interval that the walls and steps were changing in nature, as if chiseled out of the solid rock. What mainly troubled me was that the myriad footfalls made no sound and set up no echoes. After more eons of descent, I saw some side passages or burrows leading from unknown recesses of blackness to this shaft of nighted mystery. Soon they became excessively numerous, like impious catacombs of nameless menace, and their pungent odor of decay grew quite unbearable. I knew we must have passed down through the mountain and beneath the earth of Kingsport itself, and I shivered that a town should be so aged and maggoty with subterraneous evil. Then I saw the lurid shimmering of pale light, and heard the insidious lapping of sunless waters. Again I shivered, for I did not like the things that the night had brought, and wished bitterly that no forefather had summoned me to this primal rite. As the steps in the passage grew broader, I heard another sound, the thin, whining mockery of a feeble flute, and suddenly there spread out before me the boundless vista of an inner world, a vast fungus shore, litten by a belching column of sick greenish flame, and washed by a wide oily river that flowed from abysses frightful and unsuspected to join the blackest gulfs of immemorial ocean. Fainting and gasping, I looked at that unhallowed Erebus of titan toadstools, leprous fire, and slimy water, and saw the cloaked throngs forming a semicircle around the blazing pillar. It was the Yule Rite, older than man and fated to survive him, the primal rite of the solstice and of spring's promise beyond the snows. The rite of fire and evergreen, light and music. And in the Stygian grotto I saw them do the rite, and adore the sick pillar of flame, and throw into the water handfuls gouged out of the viscous vegetation, which glittered green in the chlorotic glare. I saw this, and I saw something amorphously squatted far away from the light, piping noisomely on a flute. And as the thing piped, I thought I heard noxious, muffled flutterings in the fetid darkness where I could not see. But what frightened me most was that flaming column, spouting volcanically from depths profound and inconceivable, casting no shadows as healthy flame should, and coating the nitrous stone about with a nasty, venomous verdigris. For in all that seething combustion no warmth lay, but only the clamminess of death and corruption. The man who had brought me now squirmed to a point directly beside the hideous flame, and made stiff ceremonial motions to the semicircle he faced. At certain stages of the ritual they did groveling obeisance, especially when he held above his head that abhorrent necronomicon he had taken with him. And I shared all the obeisances, because I had been summoned to this festival by the writings of my forefathers. Then the old man made a signal to the half-seen flute player in the darkness, which player thereupon changed its feeble drone to a scarce louder drone in another key, precipitating, as it did so, a horror unthinkable and unexpected. At this horror I sank nearly to the lichened earth, transfixed with a dread not of this nor any world, but only of the mad spaces between the stars. Out of the unimaginable blackness, beyond the gangrenous glare of that cold flame, out of the Tartarian leagues through which that oily river rolled uncanny, unheard, and unsuspected, there flopped rhythmically a horde of tame, trained, hybrid, winged things that no sound eye could ever wholly grasp, or sound brain ever wholly remember. They were not altogether crows, nor moles, nor buzzards, nor ants, nor vampire bats, nor decomposed human beings, but something I cannot and must not recall. They flopped limply along, half with their webbed feet and half with their membranous wings. And as they reached the throng of celebrants, the cowled figures seized and mounted them and rode off one by one along the reaches of that unlighted river, into pits and galleries of panic, where poison springs feed frightful and undiscoverable cataracts. The old spinning woman had gone with the throng, and the old man remained only because I had refused when he motioned me to seize an animal and ride like the rest. I saw when I staggered to my feet that the amorphous flute player had rolled out of sight, but that two of the beasts were patiently standing by. As I hung back, the old man produced his stylus and tablet and wrote that he was the true deputy of my fathers who had founded the Yule worship in this ancient place, that it had been decreed that I should come back, and that the most secret mysteries were yet to be performed. He wrote this in a very ancient hand, and when I still hesitated, he pulled from his loose robe a seal ring and a watch, both with my family arms, to prove that he was what he said. But it was a hideous proof, because I knew from old papers that that watch had been buried with my great-great-great-great-grandfather in 1698. Presently, the old man drew back his hood and pointed to the family resemblance in his face, but I only shuddered, because I was sure that the face was merely a devilish waxen mask. The flopping animals were now scratching restlessly at the lichens, and I saw that the old man was nearly as restless himself. When one of the things began to waddle and edge away, he turned quickly to stop it, so that the suddenness of his motion dislodged the waxen mask from what should have been his head. And then, because that nightmare's position barred me from the stone staircase down which we had come, I flung myself into the oily underground river that bubbled somewhere to the caves of the sea, flung myself into that putrescent juice of earth's inner horrors before the madness of my screams could bring down upon me all the charnel legions these pest gulfs might conceal. At the hospital, they told me I had been found half-frozen in Kingsport Harbor at dawn, clinging to the drifting spar that accident sent to save me. They told me I had taken the wrong fork of the hill road the night before and fallen over the cliffs at Orange Point, a thing they deduced from prints found in the snow. There was nothing I could say, because everything was wrong. Everything was wrong, with the broad window showing a sea of roofs in which only about one in five was ancient, and the sound of trolleys and motors in the streets below. They insisted that this was Kingsport, and I could not deny it. When I went delirious at hearing that the hospital stood near the old churchyard on Central Hill, they sent me to St. Mary's Hospital in Arkham, where I could have better care. I liked it there, for the doctors were broad-minded, and even lent me their influence in obtaining the carefully sheltered copy of Alhazred's objectionable Necronomicon from the library of Miskatonic University. They said something about a psychosis, and agreed I had better get any harassing obsessions off my mind. So I read again that hideous chapter, and shuddered doubly, because it was indeed not new to me. I had seen it before, let footprints tell what they might, and where it was I had been, it were best forgotten. There was no one in waking hours who could remind me of it, but my dreams are filled with terror because of phrases I dare not quote. I dare quote only one paragraph, put into such English as I can make from the awkward, low Latin. "The nethermost caverns," wrote the mad Arab, "are not for the fathoming of eyes that see, for their marvels are strange and terrific. Cursed is the ground where dead thoughts live new and oddly bodied, and evil the mind that is held by no head. Wisely did Ibn Shakabau say that happy is the tomb where no wizard hath lain, and happy the town at night whose wizards are all ashes. For it is of old rumor that the soul of the devil bought hastes not from his charnel clay, but fats and instructs the very worm that gnaws, till out of corruption horrid life springs, and the dull scavengers of earth wax crafty to vex it, and swell monstrous to plague it. Great holes secretly are digged where earth's pores ought to suffice, and the things have learnt to walk that ought to crawl.
Hello, my name is Laura Bradford. I'm going to read to you a story I wrote back in 1989. It's called Mr. Claus, that's C-L-A-W-S, and it's set around Christmas time in the town of Antler Bend. Antler Bend, population 5,697, named for the spot it occupies along the banks of the Cherokee River, is at once a small town and a suburb. Like all small towns, Antler Bend has its churches, schools, C&W bars, and of course a Honda dealership. Antler Bend also supports Theodore Glover College, a private liberal arts school that sits atop a bluff to the east, peering academically into the swift current of the Cherokee. Like all suburbs, at least 50% of the wage earners residing in Antler Bend owe their fiscal allegiance to a larger city. The city in this case is Pendleton, which sits on Highway 61, also known as Bunyan Trail, about a 30-minute drive downriver. So every Monday morning, after enjoying a weekend of fresh air, clean water, and parent-child bonding, the commuters climb into their, of course, Hondas, and make the 30-minute trek to Pendleton. In Antler Bend, from the Cherokee community of Thunder Ridge to the German farm settlement of Bonnestadt, even in the academic world of Glover College, no one trusts the commuters. The commuters travel at dawn and dusk, those twilight, fog-laden times during which things are most likely to happen, and the commuters must pass through the hills. The indentations were filling with snow and almost hidden by the tangled brush near the woodpile, but Brian was sure they were footprints. A large pine shadow creeping blackly across the snow-carpeted yard pointed to them like an arrow. "See," it said, "beware." Brian looked at their huge size and felt his heart pounding beneath the sweater and parka that covered his chest. The footprints were clearly outlined, and dappled color from the gaily lighted Christmas tree in the distant dining room window only made the prints more ominous. Brian wanted to run back to the safety of the house and his grandpa's warm lap, and grandma would have hot chocolate for him, he knew. But Brian was waiting for his older brother Carl to return from the deep shadows beyond the pines. Carl was back there near the lilac hedge that defined the property's edge. It was almost a football field's length from the house, and though neither of them would ever admit it, Brian knew his brother was afraid of the dark. Carl had gone deeper into the yard, back to the old fire pit, to retrieve the axe they'd left there before the first snowfall. So Brian waited, and now the footprints, too, kept him outside in the softly falling snow. Brian knelt to examine them. In front of each toe, each one the size of Brian's fist, was a claw mark. The claw marks themselves were each as big as one of Brian's thumbs. What kind of monster could have made them? A polar bear? Bigfoot? Maybe a Wookiee? Or, Brian's eyes narrowed with suspicion, could Carl be playing one of his dumb jokes again? And Brian had been willing to stand out in the cold because of him. But Carl had been gone for a long time, and Brian started to worry. Brian's eyes kept looking at the tracks, following their path from the back of the yard to the woods and back again. Carl! Carl, hurry up! I'm not falling for it, so you might as well come back. Brian's breath blew away in white tatters. A clump of snow slid from one of the pines and landed with a muffled thud. Come on, Carl! Come on, I'm getting cold! Brian shifted nervously from foot to foot. There was no answer. The snow kept falling. Brian kicked at the large cardboard box Carl had sent him back inside for. It would have been perfect for sledding, but it was supposed to carry wood. Brian had only been gone for a minute. Well, long enough to snatch some cookies and a hug from Grandma. Carl was probably still looking for the axe, or laughing his butt off watching Brian from the woods. Carl always thought he was so smart. Brian thought he should go now and follow the tracks to the woods. That would show him. He looked at the prints again. They led away from the woodpile into the wooded lot next door. Were those eyes he saw glowing amongst the trees, or just more reflections from Christmas lights? Brian shivered and his teeth clattered like castanets. If he were brave, he would follow the tracks to the woods just in case it was Carl playing tricks. Brian stood and placed his own foot inside the print, looking from the print to the woods and back. His foot looked like a midget foot, or even a smurf foot inside it, and Brian knew it had been made by something too big for an 8-year-old to handle. Brian wanted Carl to come back. Carl was big. Carl was strong. Carl was almost 14 years old. He would know what to do. Carl would also tease Brian forever and call him a baby and a wuss if it was a joke. Either that or a liar, because Carl never believed anything Brian said anyway, and the snow would wipe the prints out if Carl didn't hurry and come back. Brian didn't care. He just wished Carl would hurry up. He pounded his mittened hands together and glanced at the gaily lighted window. He was cold and his face felt stiff. Carl better hurry, or Grandma and Grandpa might start to worry. Brian looked toward the back of the yard. He couldn't see anything. The hedge was swallowed by shadows. Carl, come on, it's not funny, okay? Carl, hurry up! Brian's breath misted and settled in drops on his eyelashes. He wasn't crying. Only babies cried. Brian blinked and wiped the drops away and saw something he hadn't noticed before. The prints were going the wrong way. He thought they were Carl's boot tracks, but no, they went the wrong way. The prints marched toward Brian and the woodpile, and they were big with claw marks. There was no other set to be seen. Brian looked down at the identical print beside him, and something gleamed beneath the overhanging brush on the pile. Something metal and shiny. Brian dropped to his knees and felt cautiously under the woodpile. The snow was cold against his jeans. Brian's hand closed around something smooth, and he slowly drew it out. It was an axe. It was the axe. Brian's mouth went dry. Crack! The pop of a snapping branch shattered the muffled quiet. Brian gasped. The sound had come from the woods. Brian stood and held the axe across his thighs, his heart hammering against the back of his throat. Carl? He asked. But his voice was only a squeak. There was only silence from the back of the yard, back where Carl, Brian's big, strong brother Carl, was looking for the axe that was here, that Brian held in his hands right now. Soon, he was sure, Carl would come back. His brother would laugh at him and call him a turkey butt for being so scared. Brian stood waiting while the footprints filled with snow.
Angela Callahan reading a piece from William Shakespeare's Hamlet. Some say that ever against that season comes, wherein our Savior's birth is celebrated, the bird of dawning singeth all night long, and then, they say, no spirit dare stir abroad. The nights are wholesome, then no planets strike, no fairy takes, nor witch hath power to charm. So hallowed and so gracious is the time. Thank you.
Christmas traditions. When was the first Christmas card sent? Why do we kiss under the mistletoe? This is Bill McKee, bringing you fun facts about some of our favorite Christmas traditions and symbols, courtesy of allthingschristmas.com. Christmas cards. A form of Christmas card began in England first when young boys practiced their writing skills by creating Christmas greetings for their parents. But it is Sir Henry Cole who is credited with creating the first real Christmas card. The first director of London's Victoria and Albert Museum, Sir Henry found himself too busy in the Christmas season of 1843 to compose individual Christmas greetings for his friends. He commissioned artist John Calcott Horsley for the illustration. The card featured three panels, with the center panel depicting a family enjoying Christmas festivities, and the card was inscribed with the message, "A Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to you." Mistletoe. Mistletoe was used by Druid priests 200 years before the birth of Christ in their winter celebrations. They revered the plant since it had no roots yet remained green during the cold months of winter. The ancient Celtics believed mistletoe to have magical healing powers and used it as an antidote for poison, infertility, and to ward off evil spirits. The plant was also seen as a symbol of peace, and it is said that among Romans, enemies who met under mistletoe would lay down their weapons and embrace. Scandinavians associated the plants with Frigga, their goddess of love, and it may be from this that we derive the custom of kissing under the mistletoe. Those who kiss under the mistletoe have the promise of happiness and good luck in the following year. The candy cane. It was not long after Europeans began using Christmas trees that special decorations were used to adorn them. Food items such as candies and cookies were used predominantly, and straight white candy sticks were one of the confections used as ornamentation. Legend has it that during the 17th century, craftsmen created the white sticks of candy in the shape of a shepherd's crook at the suggestion of the choir master at the Cologne Cathedral in Germany. The candy treats were given to children to keep them quiet during ceremonies at the living creech, or nativity scene, and the custom of passing out the candy crooks at such ceremonies soon spread throughout Europe. According to the National Confectioners Association, in 1847, German immigrant August Imgard used the candy cane to decorate a Christmas tree in Wooster, Ohio. More than 50 years later, Bob McCormick of Albany, Georgia, supposedly made candy canes as treats for family, friends, and local shopkeepers. McCormick's brother-in-law, Catholic priest Gregory Keller. More recent explanations of the candy cane symbolism hold that the color white represents Christ's purity, the red the blood he shed, and the presence of the three red stripes the Holy Trinity. While factual evidence for these notions does not exist, they have become increasingly common and at times are even represented as fact. Regardless, the candy cane remains a favorite holiday treat and decoration.